And now,
the definition.
The Thanksgiving holiday also marked National Family Week. During his proclamation, President Trump said that family is, quote, the bedrock of our nation. The American Principles Project commended the president's proclamation, calling his family focus good politics.
So that same organization is pushing a family-first agenda. So according to a report released earlier this month, survey data found that the GOP needs to be more pro-family to survive politically. So joining us to expand on this is the executive director of the American Principles Project, Terry Schilling. Terry, welcome to the show.
It's great to see you.
Hey, absolutely. So, Terry, you're a strange bedfellow of mine in the same, you know, project to try and remake the right and kind of shift it away more from some of these more libertarian ideas. Just tell us a little bit about what the organization is about, the agenda, and the whole putting family first as a platform for the GOP.
Yeah, what we're trying to do is very simple. Yeah. There is a huge gap when it comes to the pro-family movement, mm-hmm. and that gap is politics. There's a lot of pro-family groups out there that focus on policy or educational efforts, but there's no one that's filling the gap in bridging, electoral politics and public policy. So what we want to do basically is become the NRA, but for the family, to where groups that are opposing us, are opposing the family, they recognize us as their political adversaries, and politicians, more importantly, are recognizing us as someone to be fearful of because we might come in an election and run some ads against
them. So what does that mean, though, to be pro-family? Because that can be defined a whole lot of different ways. Yeah.
We define it very simply. It means supporting the family through the economy, making sure that our tax code is not cutting families out or punishing them for different areas or different aspects of family life. Mm-hmm. But it also means protecting parental rights when it comes to making medical decisions for our children. Mm-hmm. You're seeing this issue crop up across the country where parents are losing custody of their kids. They're fighting over the custody of their kids when it comes to like gender transitions, which is a really controversial thing. Requires being pro-life, requires educational choice, letting parents set the educational agenda for their children and be in charge of that. So that's kind of we want to attack the issues where the family is being assaulted most, both economically and socially.
I think economically, though, is the most important one here to really talk about. You talked about this in particular, which is our tax code is not really engineered in order to encourage the growth for more children. This is, of course, encourage the births of more children. Right now, we are living in a system really where it's more beneficial in order to have less kids and in order to put it over later. We talked about this in yesterday's show in which basically the fertility rate has dropped to what, a 2018 an all-time low.
Yep.
And I think that that is something, I mean, talk about economically some of the policy proposals that would put that forward.
So the first issue, we're trying to go small bites first because, you know, I've met with a lot of different conservative economists who are experts in this stuff, and there's a real dearth of proposals to help the family. We have plenty to help corporate America and help, you know, entrepreneurs and job creators grow and expand their businesses, but there's nothing geared towards alleviating the economic burden of families. One of the first plans that we've adopted and that we've been supporting is the Cassidy-Sinema paid family leave bill.
Sure.
This is an interesting thing because it's a totally free market bill. It doesn't create a new welfare program. What it does is it gives you a $5,000 advance of the child tax credit. So look at today. You get married out of college to another girl that graduated, you know, you both got $40,000, $50,000 worth of debt. That's a mortgage. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of having a kid when you can barely make ends meet just to pay your student loans off is kind of scary to take time off of work and all of that. And so what we want to do is give these couples that have a baby $5,000 right away. Right, as soon as they have the baby, they can spend it to take time off. They can spend it to pay down medical bills. And they pay for that by getting a reduced tax credit. So instead of $2,000 a year for the child, they'd only get $1,500. So they're still getting more money than they were before, and they're getting a little bit of relief and certainty.
But so I'm a mother of three, and I think about these issues a lot. And as you point out, one of the biggest challenges is the economic issue. You come out of school, you're just crushed with debt that you've got to pay off, right? If you have a kid, the child care costs, and especially if you want to have quality child care, are astronomical. And it can lead some working class families to having to have less than ideal child care situations for their kids, which is just like the worst possible situation to be put in. So what about some of the more sweeping ideas like, you know, a Sanders or Warren idea to cancel student debt? or the idea is to provide free quality childcare where it's essentially an extension of the public education system. I mean, are those some of the things that you're open to?
I think we need to have a broader conversation about how to solve those issues, but we can't, on the conservative side of things, we have to offer an alternative that's based in conservative free market principles that's not based in...
You're talking from building a coalition perspective.
Yeah.
I hear you. Yeah.
But not even building a coalition, but doing the right thing.
What are those ideas, though?
So right now, what we're working on is a very big plan to make changes in the tax code that would equal the playing field between how corporations are treated and how families are treated. So what a lot of people don't realize, and I've written about this in the Daily Caller, is that, you know, if you're a business and you have to pay to train or educate your employees, you get to deduct all of that from your profits at the end of the year, and you don't pay any taxes on that. But if I'm a parent and my children are stuck in a really crummy school district and I have to hire a tutor or send them to a different school, I have to pay taxes on all of that. Mm-hmm. Now, we can do things in the tax code to create parity between how corporations are treated and how families are treated. And I think that's a big first step. And that's something that we can do in the free market that would not create any new government programs that would
Let me just push back on this whole free market idea. Because, I mean, part of the problem for families is the free market. I mean, part of why it is so hard to have kids is because of profit-seeking entities constantly pushing costs up and pushing costs up. It's because of the necessity of having mom and dad working because the wages are not enough to be able to support a family on one job. So don't you have to challenge that free market ideology?
So I think part of the problem has actually not been the free market, but has also been government involvement. I mean, if you look at what happens with student loan subsidies and tuition subsidies, all that does is it jacks up the price. I mean, we've done, ever since we started getting involved in the student loan industry, we've seen the price of college tuition skyrocket. And I think there's a direct connection there. It, you know, people forget that prices are the product of what businesses can charge and what schools can charge and what people can afford. And so it's like what you guys are talking about with UBI. I think the biggest problem with UBI right now is you give someone $1,000 more per month. Well, what does that tell landlords?
Right.
They can jack your rent up $1,000 more a month.
I think what we're getting in with the government thing is more, it's not that the government itself got involved. It was a government and a corporate alliance, which basically made it so that they, no, the person who goes on the hook is not the government, it's not the corporations, it's the people who actually take out the debt. And then you can't ever declare yourself bankrupt from that debt. And it really is something that screws the consumer most of all. And it's having major social implications for how people govern their lives and how they go through their society. I mean, I do think, Terry, like from a higher level perspective, this is a new, kind of a new direction for the right, or I guess maybe an old direction. It harkens back to, you know, the 40s and the 50s. Why do you think that is, and why is it so much of the current movement is dominated so much by corporate interests?
Well, so it's just kind of been the product of, you know, twisting every single year. When Reagan started off with his tax cuts, they were not geared towards helping rich people grow and expand their businesses.
Right.
They were actually geared at eliminating prohibitive taxes and inhibitive taxes. So at that time, the highest tax rate, I think, was 70%. Mm. And when someone went to go expand their business when they were in that middle range, they wouldn't because, well, I'm not going to double my business and work twice as hard to get 30 cents in the dollar. So he was actually, his tax cuts were started off and they were really great because they were aimed at the middle guys. Mm-hmm. And now the Republicans and the conservatives think, oh, it's trickle-down economics. We almost like took what George H.W. Bush tried to misframe them as, oh no, this works and this is what it is. I think, though, that at the end of the day, what we have to get back to is the contrasting between the Democrats. Mm-hmm. The Democrats are obviously the party of big government. They want more people dependent on the government. And the Republican Party faces a challenge right now. Do we become the party of more government or just a little bit less government than the left? Mm-hmm. Do we become the party of no government or less government? Or do we become the party of the family? And we want our party and our movement to be the party of the family. The family is the coolest thing about the world. It is the most beautiful thing besides maybe religion. But like, you know, you have marriages and you have children that come from that. It's the most beautiful thing. And what parents are willing to do and sacrifice for their kids, we need to get back to that. And what I don't like about these government-funded programs for childcare, for example, is that it encourages more women to get outside of the home and be away from their kids. And I think that if women actually had the choice to either enter the workforce, I think a lot more of them would actually want to stay home with their kids. I think a lot of women...
How does having the option of childcare encourage women to work outside the home? Why is that an issue? Sorry, as a woman who works outside the home, and as you know, someone who has lots of friends who work outside the home and have families, I don't see that as a negative thing to have the option of being able to at least afford to work and have the life that you want to live.
So there was actually a really interesting Twitter thread with Orrin Cass a couple months ago where he uncovered this article from the New York Times in 1972. And the New York Times embedded a reporter in the Soviet Union, and they interviewed women because there was a big difference between how women in the Soviet Union lived and how families operated versus how women operated and families operated here. And he went to these women in the Soviet Union and said, you know, you all work and you're not able to do your own private daycares. You have to, like, give them to a government-run daycare.
No one is saying anyone has to give their kids to a government-run daycare.
I understand. And this is the weird thing about, and this is what the point of what Orrin Cass was saying is that at that time in the 70s, it wasn't a choice for them. And they kind of looked down on the American women like, aren't they bored with all this? Like, aren't they bored with their children? Like, don't they want to go out and work and contribute to their economy and their country? And Orrin Cass's point was, America, over the last several years, through our limit or through our no limits on the free market and through this cronyism that we've allowed to happen between government and big corporations, what has happened is we've freely chosen this. So we have headed in the direction where moms are outside the home, they're forced to work now. And so, like, while no one's saying
what
you have
about
to
dads?
Well, dads have always been the, you know, the guys that go out and, like, hunt animals and are the providers. I mean, it's kind of like the historical role that dads have always played. But mothers are the nurturing body in the family. Like, it's interesting.
I mean,
there's a lot of social science on this.
These ideas sound very, honestly, sort of authoritarian. Like, you're telling women they should be in the home and men should be out in the workforce and we should have government policies that essentially force that choice.
Absolutely not. No. I'm just saying I don't want to create a whole government program. I think if you're a woman and you're a mom, you should absolutely be able to go to college, work whenever you want, do whatever. I don't want any authoritarianism. What I'm saying is I want women and moms and families to have the choice between working. And right now they don't have the choice,
right,
really.
Because they don't have affordable child care.
I think that would exacerbate the problem with offering subsidies. I think that's a whole mess that you don't want to get involved in. What we really want to do is alleviate the economic burdens of families. Look at what Hungary is doing over there. They're offering incentives to get people getting married earlier, having children earlier. If you're a mom of four kids, you don't pay any income taxes. Every kid that you have is a reduction in your federal income taxes. So if you have one kid, it's 25%, two kids, it's 50%, and 100% if you have four kids. Now, you would think, well, if moms don't have to pay any taxes, they're going to work a lot more. No, they work even less.
Yeah, they work quite a bit less. And their fertility rate has actually increased quite a bit. I mean, they did start very much in the hole. But it's an interesting discussion.
Hungary is a whole other can of worms, because the reason they're encouraging that is because of their incredibly xenophobic anti-immigrant policies. And they've had a massive brain drain of a tenth of the country leaving because of those policies.
And
but we will save that conversation
and the EU,
for
and the
another
European
day.
Union.
Appreciate you guys.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks,
Terry. Appreciate it, man.
A lot more Rising after this.
Class war. Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Brian Meredith. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. How y'all doing? I want to give a great thanks to the people at Hill TV. Or really the Hill, I suppose, and what they post on YouTube, because I find a lot of great material from their program. You just heard the audio version of this segment from The Hill called Family Group Tries to Shift the Future of the GOP. And here's the thing, I don't want to dissect what was said in the actual video. What I want to do is I want to talk to you about something that is actually very important to me. As, you know, I tell everybody, and most people find this absolutely insane when I say it, but I consider myself a conservative and a progressive. You can't really have one without the other. And I consider myself a conservative because a lot of the ideological points, there's 10 specific points that are usually aligned with conservatism. A lot of those ideological points are necessary in a society. You do need those to survive. The Russell Kirk Center, who is a man who wrote a horrendous book called The Conservative Mind, it was needlessly complex, but nonetheless important in trying to extract these principles. The book was needlessly complex. It was meant to kind of mirror the East Coast academic elite's style of writing, which was really stuffy and dry and needlessly complex. But the book was really needlessly complex. I read through about 3 or 4 chapters of it and then skimmed through the rest just to make sure that I got the got an understanding of what he was talking about. But there were times where he would take 2 pages to say what he could have said in really one paragraph that was probably a half of a page. So, but that said, these principles are actually very important. So just to quickly run through them, at least the ones that I really find important for the society, according to the Russell Kirk Center, here we go. First, the conservative believes that there exists an enduring moral order. That order is made for man and is made for it. I'm sorry, and man is made for it. Human nature is a constant in immoral truths, and moral truths are permanent. I apologize for that, guys. So let's do that one more time. First, the conservative believes that there exists an enduring moral order. That order is made for man, and man is made for it. Human nature is a constant, and moral truths are permanent. I agree with all of that, except for the idea that human nature is a constant, because that nature shifts depending on how much the person adheres to that to that moral concept. And so that leaves a wide range of activities open. If there's a moral order, and that suggests already that human nature can go either against it or for it. But nonetheless, I'm a strong believer in that there is an enduring moral order. Number two, the conservative adheres to custom, convention, and continuity. Now, this is also very important, especially when it comes to the idea of a structure of a society. You do need a sense of continuity. You do need a sense of customs, connection within that order. And then, obviously, convention comes with both of those. The difference is, and this is why progressivism is so necessary, if all that you are trying to gain is continuity, is custom, is convention, then you're never going to grow. You will never grow. And that's where progressivism comes in. If a baby is a great example, and I've used this before and I'll use it again here. A baby is a great example of the principles of conservatism and progressivism working together as that child grows. The conservative principles maintains the structure of that child. The progressive principle ensures that in 20 years, that baby is not a baby. That baby is a 20-year-old. That's the two of those concepts working together. And we are made to think that we have to choose one or the other. But seriously, if you didn't have a conservative ethic in that baby, and all you had was a progressive ethic, that baby would turn into a puddle of nothing. Because there wouldn't be no structural integrity. That's the continuity. That's the convention. That's even the custom.
The custom is how all of the parts of that baby relates to one another, and how that and how that relationship changes. So the third one, conservatives believe in what may be called the principle of prescription. And to explain this, let me read a little bit of this. Conservatives sense that modern people are dwarfs on the shoulders of giants, able to see farther than their ancestors only because of the great stature of those who have preceded us in time. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. That is one reason why any country, any nation, any group, any tribe looks back on those who have come before and what they teach. In fact, this is also why many conservatives secretly dislike other cultures being able to reflect back to a time when Europeans didn't control everything, because there is a fear of conservatives that if you allow these groups to reflect back to that time period and to remember those men and women that were great and that fought against white imperialism and white encroachment, then they'll be able to rise up and throw off white dominance. It works in both ways. So that's where that continuity comes from too, where they have to keep that boot onto the neck of those that they have conquered, lest those who they have conquered throws off the oppression and says, you know, I'm done with this. I'm over with it. I'm going. I'm moving forward. See you later. So it can work positively and negatively. But progressivism, what progressivism does is it helps to look at those things and say, okay, if we're trying to live up to these set of principles, we'll read the preamble to the Constitution to understand a lot of those principles. And if we're talking about democracy, then we obviously have to distill those negative traits out of who we are, out of our customs, so that we can be more purely aligned with these higher ideals. And that will probably encourage us to take the heel off of other people's necks and throats. This is one of the major contention points between conservatives and progressives, because conservatives really hold on to the imperialist aspect of their culture, where they need to dominate other people in order to get along with them, because that is what was once necessary. And this goes even beyond just the interaction between Europeans and non-Europeans during the colonial phase. This goes back to Europe and what was happening with the groups fighting there for a couple thousand years. So these people, when they talk about continuity, when they talk about convention, when they talk about custom, it is bound up in these ideas. And so progressivism and conservatism knock heads, because one says, no, we need to let go of that, which caused so much destruction to us over the last 2,000+ years. And the other one says, we need to keep doing that because it has worked. The problem is, in that battle, conservatives are incorrect. It didn't work. It caused a lot of fragmentation to their customs and their culture, which they are trying to protect. Here, conservatives need to do a lot of reflecting and understand that in a changing world, you do need continuity, but you need to distill that continuity so that those things that no longer fit you can be let go of. And so then you can move forward strongly without being held back by those things that made you weak before. Imagine if you tried running the circulatory system of a 10-year-old child with the heart of a 3-year-old. It wouldn't work. Imagine if you tried to run the nervous system of a 12-year-old with the spinal column of a 5-year-old. It wouldn't work. This is where conservatives are kind of running up against history, because they're confusing, and I lay this at the feet of corporatists, really. I really lay this at the feet of corporatists, because they have confused this. They're trying to hold on to the past without looking at the past critically and saying, okay, what do we really need to take from that past, and what do we need to leave in the past? What should we learn from? And they get into this. Another reason why I like conservative principles. Number four, conservatives are guided by the principle of prudence. Burke, that's Edmund, for those of you who don't know, agrees with Pluto that in the statesman, prudence is chief among virtues. Any public measure ought to be judged by its probable long-run consequence, not merely by temporary advantage or popularity. Now, here's the funny thing. Most progressives do not adhere to this. In fact, they run from it. And the Russell Kirk Center continues by saying liberals and radicals, the conservatives say, are imprudent, for they dash at their objectives without giving much heed to the risk of new abuses worse than the evils they hope to sweep away. This is an interesting charge for a group of people who put Ronald Reagan as their spokesman. Tearing apart the safety social net, tearing apart the tax code to benefit a small clique of authoritarians who would want more than anything to control all of society with their wealth. So yes, I'm a big believer of the principle of prudence, but unfortunately many of them do not seem to adhere to that as quickly. Again, continuing, fifth, conservatives pay attention to the principle of variety. They feel affection for the proliferating intricacy of long-established social institutions and modes of life, as distinguished from narrowing uniformity and deadening egalitarian of radical systems. Now this, ladies and gentlemen, this by itself, the idea of principle of variety is great, but I want you to take note that conservatives are usually the ones that are talking against diversity. Diversity in its most elemental dictionary form is about variety. But here's the funny thing. If this was... Well, let me continue, and this will actually explain it. For the preservation of a healthy diversity in any civilization, there must survive orders and classes, differences in material condition, and many sorts of inequality. If this was applied from a cultural standpoint, I'd be fine with it. But what these people are this is where corporatism comes into alignment with these principles. The principle of variety isn't about classes and inequality, because inequality has, quote, always existed. If you just look at it from a definitional framework, meaning from a dictionary standpoint, it's always existed. But inequality doesn't have to mean suffering. Inequality doesn't have to mean abuse. And that is what corporatists want. And that's where the corporatism has taken conservatism and flipped it on its head. It has said that variety is suffering and abuse. It said that variety is different modes of control and hierarchical approach to societies that have been sculpted together by imperialism and colonialism. Egalitarianism, at its most basic form, doesn't eliminate distinction by what people have. What it says is that there's going to be a baseline. And nobody's going to fall below that. They're going to be comfortable there. You can have people who rise above that baseline for different levels. That's fine. That's what you want to say variety is, even though, no, that's, you know, from a natural standpoint, if you're going to talk about moral orders, which is a natural occurrence in human history. From that same natural standpoint, variety is natural. You need to have different groups of people, but the baseline is important. And that is something that conservatives, going all the way back, should have been promoting. Because if you went back to the Middle Ages, you were arguing for the king to remain kingly, and for the feudal lords to remain feudal lords, and for the serfs to remain absolutely impoverished and to be abused by those who were the feudal lords. This is what this principle is arguing as it is written. It's impossible to fit into today's world. Nobody's going to go for this. Nobody's going to go for this. No one will go for it. And so, you know, that's where your progressivism comes in. We don't live in the Middle Ages. We don't live, you know, back 2,000 years ago. We have come a long way. There is more money being produced today through capitalism than some centuries and groups of centuries produced combined. If you put together money that is being made in 1 year, you have centuries put together back to back that didn't produce that much wealth that quickly. So the variety is fine. You want to have people, you know, not everybody wants the same thing. Some people would much prefer to live a modest, meek life where they can sit and they can meditate all day and, you know, give and dispense wisdom and what have you. And then other people just want a comfortable life. But if you don't have a baseline there, your variety is, you're arguing for massive abuse. I didn't mean to get off on that, but that's massively important that we understand that. Continuing, conservatives are chastened by their principle of imperfectibility. Human nature suffers immediately from certain grave faults. The conservatives know. Everybody knows that. That's the whole moral order thing that they were talking about, and what I added to it, which was that people adhere to that code, you know, at varying levels. Man being imperfect, no perfect social order ever can be created. Nobody is advocating that. Because of human restlessness, mankind would grow rebellious under any utopian dominion and would break out once more in violent discontent or else expire of boredom. It's kind of weird because they go from one extreme to another here, but here's the thing. The principle of imperfectibility is in fact leading to progressivism. Is in fact leading to progressivism. The argument that the conservatives are making here, and I'm sorry guys, but I gotta get into this, and then I'll go to the family value thing in a moment. But the argument that they're making here is don't try, because it's just useless. When in fact the principle of imperfectibility actually says no, you try, you make the tweaks that are necessary. You make the tweaks that are necessary to grow and mature the system, knowing that each succeeding generation is likely to find new faults and then thus have to make changes. There's actually an interesting middle ground between boredom and violent revolution. There's an interesting middle ground between that. And that's called, you know, meeting the challenges of the age. Yeah, no system's going to be perfect, that's right. But it doesn't mean that you don't try. And it doesn't mean that you don't evolve. This is where staticism gets involved. See, this principle in and of itself is the principle that matters the most for conservatism, especially when you consider it the dual side, the partner of progressivism. Because what it ultimately tells you is that yes, human nature is made to be restless. Yes. But that's fine, because we have ingenuity. We can motivate and we can move forward. But it's never going to be complete, because human nature is not one to render something complete. They're not one to render something perfect. And that's fine. But they weaponize this principle, the principle of imperfectibility. They weaponize it so that it essentially boils down to don't try. When no, this is instructive. What it tells you is that every single generation will have a group of challenges which they must meet. This is the most powerful principle of conservatism, everybody. Every single generation will have a group of challenges that it must meet. In other words, the world is imperfect. Society is imperfect. Your job isn't to make it perfect. Your job is to recognize that and to understand that all you're doing is adding a little ingenuity to ingenuity that had started previously. And that each generation has to solve the problems to the best of their abilities. But you have to admit those problems and then solve them. And then you pass it on to the next generation and allow them to do what they need to do. This is a powerful, powerful principle, man. Powerful principle. That if conservatives really glommed onto it, they would see the unifying elements of their metaphysical cause, their physical cause, their spiritual cause, and the metaphysical spiritual causes of progressivism. This, again, I want to utilize here the idea of the human body getting older. Imagine if I said to you that from the standpoint of the human body, there is no principle of imperfectibility. Or should I say, there is a principle of imperfectibility, meaning you can't perfect it. You'd ask me, what do I mean? And I say, well, you know, when the baby is a baby, the baby grows and grows and grows and grows and becomes a little child, a toddler first, and then a child, then a preteen, and then a teen, and then an adult, and then, you know, later years, and then an old person, and then they pass away. There is no time where the human body is perfect. It keeps growing. And you'd say, yeah, that makes sense. Now, if I then said to you, for that reason, you shouldn't take care of the body. You shouldn't work out. You shouldn't eat well. You shouldn't drink well. You'd look at me and say, well, wait a minute. If I got to live in this thing, and it can't be perfect, but, you know, shouldn't I try to make it at least as comfortable and as amendable to the circumstances which I find myself in that I could? I would be stupid to look at you and say, no, you shouldn't. And that's what they're arguing in this principle. It's the wrong argument. They're looking at the principle of imperfectibility absolutely backwards. Continuing. Number 7, conservatives are persuaded that freedom and property are closely linked. I am not. This is the one principle that I absolutely 100% disagree with. And the reason why I disagree with this principle, because I understand that it starts with a perception that was created back in the feudalist times of Europe, where, yes, property meant everything to those on the higher rung of the ladders. And then when imperialism started, property again was placed very high. And that property included human life. So here, they may be persuaded that freedom and property are closely linked. I'm not persuaded that freedom and property are closely linked. I'm persuaded that freedom and life are closely linked. That's what I'm persuaded. And in fact, I would even go so far as to say I'm persuaded that freedom and justice are closely linked. That's where I'm at. That is the one place where they misstepped horribly. Because this tells you that it's a corporatist spin on conservative ethics. You do not need property to be free. You do not need property to be free. And I know this because Native Americans didn't need it, even though they had their own little territories. But they were still free to come and go. You do not need property to be free. And this is the one that most conservatives are fearful of losing because, again, of the historical relevance of it. It goes back to feudalist England, which I really do believe has a psychological impact on a lot of European Americans. In the deep recesses of their subconscious, they remember that their people languished under feudalist dictators for the last 2,000 years. And now they have the opportunity to have land of their own and to play the part of those feudalist dictators, some good, some bad, just like it was in Europe. And so they believe that they have earned it. I mean, I've heard so many European Americans say that, I've earned this, I've earned this, I've earned this, I've earned this. Okay, that's fine. You want to believe that. But you can have property and you cannot have freedom. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. And there's also people who do not have property and do not have freedom because those who have property abuse them so badly. Which, if you're going to start off and you're going to talk about the moral code and then you're going to bring this up, this completely undercuts the idea of the moral code. Because history proves this wrong. History proves this wrong. Unless you look at it from the standpoint of those at the top of the society, then it proves it right. Number 8. Conservatives uphold voluntary community quite as they oppose involuntary collectivism. This is a weird one, I admit that. This is a weird one because it is so wide open. Let me read a little bit of this to you because I want you to understand what this is. I'm skipping a line. In a genuine community, the decisions most directly affecting the lives of citizens are made locally and voluntarily. Some of these functions are carried out by local political bodies, others by private associations. Now, the private associations, ladies and gentlemen, that's your corporatist spin right there. That's your corporatist spin. The private associations are usually by people of means, people who have money, people who are connected into the corporate hierarchy, and particularly at the mid-level or the upper level. So, in a general community, the decisions most directly affecting the lives of citizens are made locally and voluntarily. Some of these functions are carried out by local political bodies, which are accountable to the public, may I add. Others by private associations, which are accountable to corporations mostly. So long as they are kept local and are marked by the general agreement of those affected. Now again, so long as they are kept local and are marked by the general agreement of those affected, they constitute healthy community. That is, again, that's a nod to corporatism. Because corporatists do a lot of things via associations. And then they do it in private. And then they execute it publicly, usually without much notice by the general public. What they're telling you is that it's community oriented. No. There is nothing here Okay, so let me read this, because there's nothing here that really talks about being accountable to the public, which is what this principle should actually move towards. Here is where your aristocratic concepts come in, and they move away from democracy. So in the last two, really three principles, they have moved away from democracy and placed conservatism into the hands of an aristocracy who would exercise their abilities by way of authoritative degrees. Meaning they do these things in private, like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And then they move it through a process of publishing in the public mind, but only after it's been executed against public interest. So continuing here, they constitute healthy community, but when these functions pass by default or usurpation to centralized authority, then community is in serious danger. Now, you would think that, you know, this is a nod and wink against corporatism. But the problem is it goes against the free association clause that they put in there. Because if corporations do things at a local level via association and do not necessarily pass it up the chain of command, then it actually, supposedly according to this, isn't putting community in danger. Now, one could also say that this is a way of saying, okay, we are not really for corporatist power. We are not really for corporatist power. The problem is with the idea of the associations, the majority of associations are not built by local groups. They're built by moneyed groups. They're built by corporate groups or groups that are connected deeply into corporate entities and engines. So continuing just a little bit more here, guys, whatever is beneficent, and prudent in modern democracy is made possible through cooperative volition. I've rarely seen that word used, actually, so it's kind of nice to see that. Volition is free will. But again, they nod to democracy, but everything before that, when you understand the structures of, particularly like if you look at what the Koch brothers have done, the Koch brothers have utilized this principle, but they've utilized it to build a structure which is beneficial for what they want it to be beneficial for, which is themselves. Now, of course, you would say, well, wait a minute, that's that central authority that they're talking about. Yeah, but they still consider Mr. Koch a good neoconservative libertarian, don't they? So, again, let me just finish reading this, and then I'm going to go into the last two principles, and then we'll talk about family values. Whatever is beneficent and prudent in modern democracy is made possible through cooperative volition. If, then, in the name of an abstract democracy, the functions of community are transferred to distant political direction, why? Real government, by the consent of the government, gives way to a standardized process hostile to freedom and human dignity. Now, here's the thing. Notice they didn't put corporations in there, and that's why I read the rest of this, because this principle is turned on its head by the corporate interest, the corporatist interest of neoconservatism. This is a powerful principle. It could be utilized, just as the last two could be utilized, to actually shore up democracy. But they throw democracy in there to throw you off the scent. The fact of the matter is, this is a corporate-friendly principle, how they have written it. It's a lie. It's a lie. Community, yes, is voluntarily. Is voluntary. But here's the funny thing. Collectivism is also voluntary. People collectivize themselves in a very voluntary way, and thus they amass resources in a very voluntary way. In a very voluntary way. And considering the fact that the Constitution of the United States puts the general welfare puts the charge of general welfare in the hands of government. Yes, you may want government to shrink down significantly, but it still has to uphold that principle of caring for the general welfare. This is a powerful principle, but they utilize it for corporate interests. They do not use it for the commonwealth interest. And you can tell by the way that it is structured. I, you know, just got them going into that. So let's go into number 9. And they do go a little bit more here, which I think is important for 8. It says, for a nation is no stronger than the numerous little communities of which it is composed. A central administration or a corps of select managers and civil servants, however, well-intentioned and well-trained, cannot confer justice and prosperity and tranquility upon a mass of men and women deprived of their old responsibilities. Again, you know, again, it's all about government being bad, corporations being good. And the depriving of the old responsibilities actually came via capitalism. Capitalism made a lot of the old trades extinguishable. You could get rid of them. Yes, capitalism did those trades. How am I looking to say this? They were able to produce faster than those trades, but they weren't able to always match the quality of those trades. And as soon as those trades went away almost entirely, you've seen the quality of what capitalism produced decrease dramatically. So when capitalists still had to deal with the old iron smelters, the old iron masons, you've seen the way that they built structures, the way that they built buildings. It was magnificent. It was meant to last for centuries. As soon as that went away, just about, you've seen the stability and sturdiness of the buildings decrease. So the idea of the old responsibilities going away, that happened because of capitalism. That didn't happen because of government. And in fact, to the extent that government was at fault, it was often because capitalists were driving those governments. This is historical here. So again, this is a powerful principle here, but they utilize it to prove something that is disempowering. Let's go to number 9. I know, guys, I'm taking a little bit long here, but I think this is important. So isn't the family value thing. But this is also important. 9th, the conservative perceives the need for prudent restraints upon power and upon human passions. Now, they put this here. Now, mind you, this could have easily been included with the principle on moral order. So after they go through 3 or 4 principles of essentially alleviating government of its responsibilities by saying government is the problem, constantly the problem, constantly the problem. Now they come to number 9. And here's how they started off. Politically speaking, power is the ability to do as one likes. That's a lie. That is not what politics is. They start off with a lie, a blatant one. Regardless of the wills of one's fellow, again, that only works if you have it in your mind that your society is hierarchically authoritarian. So people at the top constantly tells those at the bottom what they want to be done. Now, why this is a lie is because that goes against democracy. Now, you can all say, well, wait a minute, you know, the democracy is democracy, man. It doesn't always work that way. Yeah, but now we're talking about concepts, and if we're talking about principles, then this automatically tells you where their mindset's coming from, and it's not from democracy. Their mindset is coming from the authoritarian principle. So they're looking at government and corporation as the same. The difference is the government is accountable to the people. Corporations are not. Let me continue with this. A state in which an individual or small group are able to dominate the wills of their fellows without check is a despotism. whether it is called monarchical or aristocratic or democratic. Now, I'm sorry, but this is fantastically horrific, because they talk about monarch, they talk about aristocracy, and then they add democratic. A democracy, and this is why the aristocratic, I think it was Plato, it was either Plato or Aristotle, I always get them two mixed up, but this is why they didn't like it. I really think it was Plato who really didn't like democracy, because it took the power from the few and put it into the hands of the many. Now, I suppose if you're part of that few, yeah, you're going to look at that as a serious problem. And you're going to look at that as despotism, because you can't do what you want to do. But in fact, it's not despotism. It's just you now have to work with those who you consider your lesser. So this principle by itself just tells you where the mindset of those writing these principles come from. They're not about preserving society for the masses. They're about preserving the hierarchical structure for their benefit. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. You know, if as society goes along, you know, and it sinks down and everyone's kind of living at this subnormal rate, then it's going to be worse off for society. Well, yeah, but that only assumes that that's going to happen. Like I said, people want different things. Not everybody wants to be a millionaire. And not everybody, most people don't even want to be a millionaire. They want appropriate valuation for what they do and who they are. They want to make their families comfortable and give their families the means to live well, and then to go out and continue the cycle of living well. But they don't necessarily want what you want. What this principle gets wrong immediately is that democracy is not on the same level of an aristocratic society or a monarchical society. It's not. When every person claims, continuing here, when every person claims to be a power unto himself, then society falls into anarchy. So in other words, they are against democracy from the moment, because again, democracy says that the power is in the people, and thus every person claims to be a power unto himself. Actually, that's a brilliant exchanging of words here, because in a democracy, and I almost didn't catch it, in a democracy, every person claims to be a power unto his community, because that is where the responsibility lies, is in the community. And it's funny, because they're arguing that, you know, one principle back, but then they come out with this. So the person does have a responsibility to the community, and to the community of communities, the commonwealth. That's a democracy. So yeah, I suppose if you only care about yourself, then yeah, the society will fall into anarchy. Anarchy never lasts long, but being intolerable for everyone, and contrary to the ineluctable fact that some persons are more strong and more clever than their neighbors. Again, this is the hierarchical nonsense that they're trying to promote, where it's, we are better than you, you know that, let us rule over you. We want authoritarian mandates to rule you. So on the one hand, they're talking about, you know, whether it is called monarchy or aristocracy or democracy, but then one line later they're saying, oh yeah, but you know, some of us are just better than the rest of you. This, again, this is your corporatism, ladies and gentlemen, and I know I'm going off on this, but seriously, guys, this is we, as progressives, and I'm not a progressive, but, you know, people don't tend to go through this stuff, and they need to. So, to anarchy, there succeeds tyranny or oligarchy. Sure, aristocracy does not lead to oligarchy. Obviously, it does. It happened in the Roman Republic, the best known case of it, where aristocracy did lead to oligarchy. And people always try to argue, well, they weren't really about an aristocracy. You know, they were kind of a meritocracy. No, they weren't. Most of the families that were governing Rome when it fell had been in that position for hundreds of years. That's an aristocracy. And they did everything that they could do to keep other people from ascending to that height. Now, yes, were there some people who made it to that height who weren't born into it? Absolutely. You have the same thing here. But it still was an aristocracy. And that did ultimately lead to oligarchy. So this completely flips the whole thing on its head. And, you know, I would love to keep reading the rest of this, but I'm trying to get to the main point of this podcast. But I felt like I wanted to go through this. I was just going to read through them quickly, try to touch on some stuff for about 30 minutes, and then move on. But, you know, I'm to the final one, so let's get this done. 10th, the thinking conservative understands that permanence, I love that, the thinking conservative, you know, stroking the ego from the beginning, the thinking conservative understands that permanence and change must be recognized and reconciled in a vigorous society. So here's a nod to progressivism. Here's a nod to progressivism. The funny thing is, and with principles, you're supposed to see this. You're supposed to see a continuity of each succeeding principle. You don't necessarily see that with all of these principles, but a lot of them I do agree with. I agree at least that they are necessary, and as I've reinterpreted for you on multiple occasions, I believe that they're misinterpreted. So continuing here, the conservative is not opposed to social improvement, although he doubts whether there is any such force as a mystical progress. With a Roman P at work in the world, I don't know what a Roman P is, I don't know what that is. When a society is progressing in some respects, usually it is declining in other respects. The conservative knows that any healthy society is influenced by two forces, which Samuel Taylor Coleridge calls its permanence and its progression. The permanence of a society is formed by those enduring interests and convictions that give us stability and continuity. I've been talking about that, ladies and gentlemen. I've been talking about that. Without that permanence, the foundations of the great deep are broken up. Society slipping into anarchy. The progression in a society is that spirit and that body of talents which urge us on to prudent reform and improvement. Without that progression, a people stagnate. Duh! I've been talking about that too, have I not? So therefore, the intelligent conservative endeavors to reconcile the claims of permanence and the claims of progression. He thinks that the liberal and the radical, blind to the just claims of permanence, would endanger the heritage bequeathed to us in an endeavor to hurry us into some dubious terrestrial paradise. Now, the conservative, in short, favors reason and temperate progress. He is opposed to the call to progress, whose votaries believe that everything new necessarily is superior to everything old. And yeah, that's just a way of escaping real, much-needed radical progress by claiming that it's just too far against, you know what has been done. Well, here's the problem with that. And he thinks that the liberal and the radical, blind to the just claims of permanence, would endanger the heritage bequeathed to us. If the heritage bequeathed to you came from imperialism, racism, degradation, and hierarchical mismanagement, which devastated millions of people, then yeah, you need to get rid of that bequeathment. You don't want somebody bequeathing you the flu. You don't want somebody bequeathing you an injection of a deadly virus that may or may not kill you on your 21st birthday. Now, some of you may laugh and go, well, wait a minute, man, come on, seriously, no one's going to do that. Yeah, but this is a metaphor that is apt here. If you have something that has bequeathed you that is so detrimental to the society and to the structures of the society because of what it has done previously, or what it took, should I say, to build it up previously, then you are literally asking for an infection that's going to destabilize everything that you supposedly hold dear. This is where distillation should come in for conservatives. A principle that might need it to be added is the principle of reflection, of where one's coming from and where one is supposed to be heading towards. Because truthfully, you only have two poles on this spectrum. And they don't even recognize that there's poles. At least not in their principles. The pole is authoritarianism or authoritative hierarchy to populism or democratic populism, or even one can say a democratic hierarchical populism. It is a question of where is your society heading. If you are trying to maintain the hierarchical necessities of the past, then you're going to invite aristocracy, you're going to invite oligarchy, you're going to invite massive abuses from the system to maintain that. If you are trying to head towards that democratic hierarchical populism, you are going to have to do some massive structural readjustments. And the problem with many conservatives is they don't want to do that. Now, where does this all fit in for family values? Family values impacts all of that because it is the smallest unit of any community. Some might say, well, wait a minute, isn't the person the smallest unit? Yeah, but the person is a product of the family. When you are looking at capitalism, and you are trying to determine how it can bolster family values, you have to understand first and foremost that capitalism has been the great destroyer of family values. Now, I know we don't like to think about this, but it is the truth. Without going into imperialism, without going into colonialism, without going into what had to actually happen to those people who needed to be removed or needed to be beaten into submission in order to build the foundation for capitalism, which is a foundation that capitalism will always strive to recreate. If we look at capitalism in the United States back in the late 1800s, what you see is an absolute disregard for family well-being, family health, and family dignity. They did not care, just as they didn't care for blacks who were working sharecropping during that time period. If a black woman was pregnant, she could be forced to have that child out in the field. And then she'd have to go quickly back to work within the next couple of days. They did the same thing to Europeans in this country who were working for the corporations. And if they needed to lay off a whole mess of Europeans in order to save the big bosses some money, they would do that, throwing massive amounts of families into financial disarray, especially when the corporations owned the housing which they were staying in. They would lay off the workers and then throw them out on the street, whether it was raining, shining, or snowing. This is a history of capitalism that we do not see, and that we are prevented from seeing. If you want to truthfully care about family values, you're going to have to change capitalism. Because, one, capitalism is in its late stages. Two, capitalism is going to morph into something. And three, we might want to get on to figuring out what it's going to morph into, because I already see where the wealthy is going. I already see what they're trying to do. What is absolutely shocking, if you watch the video from The Hill, what you see is this guy. And look, I'm not the most attractive guy, so I don't tend to pick on people's appearance, and I'm not going to pick on his per se. But what you see is a guy who almost looks as slimy as a salesman. He, from the moment that the camera comes on, I mean, you know, some people might say, well, he's just an easy being on camera. Okay, fine. But he has the slickness to him. And there's a bit of disingenuity with the guy. There is. If you want to get GOP back onto family values, you're going to have to get them off capitalism. When you're trying to protect corporations, and look, I know I just kind of switched out on you guys, but there is, he's a great example. He's a great example of the almost empty suitedness. And I don't know the guy. The guy might be the nicest guy in the world, but he just seems like an empty suit. Spitting talking points that just, it doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work anymore. That you've been found out. If you really want to get them, if conservatism has spent the last 25 years covering for corporations, if you want to really get back to family values, you're going to have to change the way that corporations work, and that means changing the way that you approach capitalism, and most of these people don't want to deal with that. You're going to have to insert some forms of socialism. And I know, oh my God, it's so horrible, socialism. But that's what you're going to have to do. And if you ain't willing to do that, if you're not ready to tell that truth, then you're wasting everybody's time. Somebody tell him that. He's wasting everybody's time. And I understand that The Hill's trying to act like, you know, we're centrist. We care about real conservatives who are trying to figure out how to deal with this stuff and deal with that. Conservatives, if, you know, I read you the 10 principles. I went through those 10 principles for you. If you are still tied up with corporatist thinking, you are doing nothing good for America. You are doing nothing good for Main Street. You are doing nothing good for anybody but corporate America. That's it. And you may not like that. I'm fine with that. But from where I'm sitting, I know you're lying. When you're telling me that, you know, by holding yourself strongly to conservative, corporatist, conservative principles that protect the, quote, job makers, that you are protecting America, you're lying to me. And I know that, because I've seen what your job creators have done over the last 30 years. Your job creators give two blanks about freaking families. They don't care about families. In fact, from what they're doing overseas, I can tell they hate families. When you are paying 12-year-old girls $2 or $3 an hour, because you don't want to come back to America. And by the way, this is for stuff that's produced and then shipped to America. And because you don't want to have to come back to America and pay people $20, so you can line your pockets. You hate families. There's nothing that you can do to tell me differently. And I've talked to, you know, neo-libertarians. I've talked to, you know, the new Main Street conservatives who are spitting this corporate libertarianism, this fascism. And these people really do believe that they're helping their families. And what I continuously tell them is what you are advocating is not going to have the ends that you think, because you are aiming for authoritative governing principles. That's what you want. You want your people to be at the top and everybody else to be below them. That's what you want. You will destroy society doing that. And pure and simple, they will. The question is, are we willing to let them? Because contrary to what these people keep saying, they're not a majority. They're a minority. When you read through the 10 principles, and I encourage you, type in Russell Kirk Center Conservative Principles into Google and go and look at it. When you read through these principles are meant to protect a minority of people. They are so afraid of the majority because they are a minority. They are small. They are able to magnify their voice because of the media. What does media mean? What's the definition of it? Go to the Oxford, the large multi-volume Oxford dictionary and look it up. They're small, and they know it. That's why they're afraid of democracy. That's why they keep co-opting populism as a right-wing concept, when in historical context, populism was not right-wing. They believed in family values, I'll tell you that. But they looked at family values a lot differently than these people did. They also believed in community, but they were not corporatists. They were fighting against the corporations. Most of you don't know that, but they were. So I'm going to leave this right here. This is over an hour worth of time. I'm publishing a couple of different episodes today. So, you know, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, let me know. This was a good one. I enjoyed this one because I like talking about conservative principles. Progressives, y'all need to get on your balls and game, man. You need to get together your principles. I was thinking about putting together a group of like 10 of them too, and just, you know, this is what progressives kind of, you know, think about this, and this. But I'm a nobody, basically. You know, what kind of authority do I have to put that down, you know? But maybe I'll do it anyway. Maybe I'll do it anyway for next year and make up a list of maybe 10 principles that will explain progressivism, at least in my eyes, and then let everybody just tear it apart if they want. All right, guys, so this is your brother, Brian Merdis. I will see you on the other side. Actually, I'm sorry. I will see you on the other side. No, this is it. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can hit me up on my email. It's always on the front of every single episode that I do. So, you know, don't hesitate. Reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. Again, this is your brother, Brian Merdis. I'll see you on the next episode. Peace. Where their business interest runs, on the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And